I doubt that any of you listening doesn't feel the effects of stress from time to time, but our guest today says that there are ways that we can alter our outlook in order to minimize stress and to improve our overall quality of life. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Amit Sood is a professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, and he's chair of the Mind-Body Medicine Initiative at Mayo Clinic. His research interests include stress management, resilience training, meditation, smoking cessation, and cancer symptom control. He's the author of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living, and he joins us from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Amit Sood, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Judith. We are excited to bring Mayo Clinic approach to happier and relatively stress-free life.
Well, and I think, you know, with the start of a new year, it's always a good time to think about how we can kind of reset things that we might like to do a little differently and how to, you know, start off a new year with a good outlook. I noticed in reading the book, it's very interesting to me that in a book that is titled The Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living, the actual word stress really doesn't come up that often. Why is that?
Well, we want to focus on resilience, on strength, on our ability to better handle stress. Stress is looking backward. It is sort of us in survival mode, but we are capable of better. We want to grow, move forward, and use stressors, which are always going to be there, to help us transform.
And I think that the fact that stressors are always going to be there, you do a really good job of showing that that's not necessarily a bad thing. Stress actually can motivate us in different ways. If there were no kind of stressors, if there was no tension in our lives, we probably wouldn't get out of bed in the morning.
Absolutely. If I was to ask you what makes you happy today, your list might include kids, house, perhaps your job, your car, your spouse, prayer, and many other such things. And but if we were to ask you what gets you stressed, the list, except for prayer, might be the same. You know, kids, house, car, spouse, work, etc. So the list of stressors and the list of joy is the same. It is how we engage with it. That is what makes quite a bit of difference.
Well, I really like that this is the Mayo Clinic Guide, and so, of course, there's very deep and well-researched medical and physiological information that provides the underpinning for this. Let's set the stage a little bit with how the brain actually works. You talk about focused mode and default mode. How do they differ, and what are they?
Yes. Oh, that is very exciting, and we are learning more about it as the years roll by. But only for the last decade or so, we know this explicitly. Our brain, at the whole brain level, sort of toggles between two modes. One of them is the focused mode. Focused mode. A perfect example is, say, if you step out and you see a baby elephant dancing in your cul-de-sac, that'll get your brain in the focused mode. Or you run into your high school buddy, that gets your focused mode. Our brain loves to be entertained. Anytime you find something which is very interesting and engaging, your brain comes in the focused mode. You're generally intentional and externally focused at this time. But there is a second mode, Judith, and that is called the default mode. Let me ask you this question. Have you ever read a book, you read half a page, and then you say, what was I reading?
More than I would care to admit.
So where were you at that time? You were mind-wandering at that time. And what research shows is we spend half the day every day with a wandering mind thinking about all the unresolved issues in life. And an average person has over 150 undone tasks at any time.
Is that what you refer to as open files in your brain?
Absolutely. So brain gets busy trying to handle them. So anytime my external world is not very engaging, I'm lost with that wandering mind. And when I'm in my mind's wanderings, I'm thinking neutral or negative thoughts. I don't know of anybody who sits in a corner and says, okay, I'm going to think all happy thoughts today. Mm-hmm. We're mostly stewing on stuff. And that is what gets us very, very busy.
And those open files are not necessarily, I mean, in one sense, like if you think of open files on your computer, well, those are probably documents you're working on or projects that you're in the process of. But those brain open files or those mind open files are often things that, as you said, are well past. There's nothing we can do to change them. And they're just really taking up valuable kind of hard drive space and also attention.
Absolutely. Your brain is a premium real estate. If you had a lot on Fifth Avenue in New York, you wouldn't put a dumpster on it, right? Similarly, we have finite number of thoughts we can think through this life. So we should engage our brain and think thoughts and engage in activities that are really worthy and meaningful to us. Open files could be any little thing. It could be a leaky faucet, an eye roll from your teenager, or somebody's illness, an upcoming bill, or an appointment or party. You name it.
And those open files are, it sounds like you're saying that sometimes they're things that we actually do need to kind of keep tabs on, but often the way that we're thinking about them or kind of perseverating about them is not the healthy way to address them.
That is precisely right. Many of them are not addressable. For example, if your parent has been diagnosed with mild memory impairment, you cannot do anything about it right now. But we keep engaging because our attention is sort of glued to threat. And imperfections are the modern threats. And anytime there is some imperfection, we try to fix it. The other part is the sheer number of open files. Most people I meet have over 20 user IDs at any time. I don't want you to guess, but I'm sure you've got that many user IDs.
Probably
that
close
you have to
it.
Juggle. Yeah, and so many bills to pay. My parents didn't have to do that, and most likely your parents didn't. So our brains are overextended. We are overcommitted. We are very busy. We are a generation of jugglers. We're juggling too many things.
And it sounds like recent research is finding that we're never really multitasking. We're actually just skipping our attention from one thing to the other.
That is right. So we can at any time handle one task, but when we become good at it, we start jumping from one task to the other, just like a movie. If you've got the reels going very fast, you see it's a continuous motion. Similarly, you feel like you're multitasking, but you're jumping from one task to the other very quickly. Now, sometimes you have to do it. If you're going through airport security check, you have to do it. But the problem is when you multitask in the context of relationships. Whenever I'm talking to my wife on the phone and looking at the computer screen at the same time and trying to reply to an email, I'm always caught and I have to pay back sometime later.
And it would have probably been better and easier from the start just to be focusing on your wife, for instance, in that.
Absolutely,
in that
I've learned my lesson the hard way, and so I try not to go there, but I must say I still sometimes commit those mistakes, and I'm almost always caught.
Well, it sounds like a lot of what's going on in our brain is really much more related to what our ancestors' lives were. Like you talked about just our parents' generation not having as much stimulus and demands, but let's go back much further than that. Millennia ago, you talked about how our brains are really trained to identify and address threat because that was what was going to keep us alive. How does that specifically not make it a good fit for our lives today?
Right. So we have a medieval brain running modern world. That is a big challenge we face. It takes time for evolution to rewire, or as I sometimes say, right-wire our brain. So our brain is obsessed with safety, which is to some extent correct. I mean, we have to do that. But most of the external threats are now replaced by internal threats. Few people are worried about physically being assaulted, but we've got a lot of open files in our head. We worry about embarrassing somebody or ourselves. We worry about not meeting a deadline or not fulfilling a promise, getting late, not meeting a deadline. Those are our worries. And not hosting the perfect party, disappointing people. And you know, as Mark Twain said, I've suffered several terrible things in my life, some of which actually happened.
That's a great quote.
Yes, yes. So we pay installments on a principle that doesn't even exist. So you wouldn't take a mortgage with that kind of sort of deal. So, but that's what we do. We do this because our brain is a fault-finding machine. It gets busy with wherever it finds fault. And the most of the faults we have now are in our head.
Well, and I just had to laugh when you said, you know, the stress of, say, throwing the perfect party. And if you think back to the threats that, you know, our prehistoric ancestors were dealing with, I don't think that they would find that a very valid threat to be worried about.
Absolutely. It's all relative. I don't mean to say it's not a valid threat for us. We keep revising expectations. So it is, but the downside is that our body doesn't know better. Our body is not that intelligent to tell difference between the threat of a predator versus threat of an imperfect party. Our stress response is very generic, and it produces the same chemicals when you're chased by a lion versus when you're having a panic attack related to an imperfect party.
We are talking with Dr. Amit Sood. He is the author of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living, and he's joining us today from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. We'd love to have you join in. Do you deal with stress in your life that you feel like you could be handling better and would like some advice? I'm sure Dr. Sood would be happy to help with that. Or we'd like to hear also if you have found some techniques that work well for you in keeping things in perspective and taking a more positive approach to the things that sometimes bring us stress. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carl Christensen is our on-air producer today. He will be happy to take your calls. You can also email questions or comments to talk@WPR.org, or you can post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Dr. Amit Sood. He's a professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and chair of the Mind-Body Medicine Initiative at Mayo Clinic. He is the author of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living, and he joins us from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Thanks again for spending time with us, Dr. Sood.
Thank you, Judy.
Let's take some calls. Actually, there's a lot I want to get to, but we want to make sure we include our listeners as well. So let's go to Chris in Adams County. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I've been waiting for you to have somebody like this for a long time.
Well, the wait is over.
Okay, well, we'll see. I have been dealing with an incredibly stressful situation since 1986, and I lost my access to my education, a $40,000 doctoral fellowship, my home of 20 years, and all of my belongings. My life was threatened, and when I figured out the corruption in Wisconsin government behind this whole thing, they sicked the Madison SWAT team on me. I'm not making this up. I ended up in the hospital. I developed a very, very dangerous heart arrhythmia. And fortunately, when I had my grand mal seizure, I was talking to my physician about what happened to me. And if you're going to have a grand mal seizure, you may as well have it in front of your doctor because you get taken pretty good care of. My question is this. When you have a situation this huge, I mean, there was a cover-up of the U.S. Department of Justice investigation in this and all this stuff. If you have something this huge going on in your life that you can't get out from under, because I can't get out from under it, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. So in Chris's situation, Dr. Sood, it sounds like it's virtually all external factors and things that she really can't change. And you really do address that in the book quite thoroughly.
Yes, thanks for that question. It's, you know, I'm sorry to hear all the challenges that you have faced. I think mounting on those challenges is what happens is you start feeling, you start doubting yourself. You start challenging, you know, are you even capable? Am I? People start doubting you. You get into a phase of guilt and feel vulnerable. You can work on all of that by first validating yourself. You didn't create it of your own. You trust your intention. You focus on what is right within what is wrong. You still have intellect, mental faculty. You have survived to some extent. You have come out of this. Have self-compassion, self-acceptance, and self-forgiveness. And then ask yourself, what are my strengths? who are my loved ones? Who are my true friends? Has this experience helped me understand that? Has it given me a broader perspective towards challenges that people face in their life? And what can I build from here? And what meaning eventually can I find out of it? Do I want to look back 20 years from now and see this as an event that transformed me? Or do I want to see this as an event that just put me down and I've continued to remain in that state? You know, I don't know your age, but, you know, most of us who are around in 40s and 50s have about 15,000 days left in this life. And I do have done that math for myself. And you truly have a choice. How do you live each day? How do you wake up each day? Are you going to empower yourself? Or are you going to let those external factors put you down for the rest of your life? You have a choice.
I think that's a great point for Chris that you made, Dr. Sudin, and it reminded me, I believe it was Viktor Frankl that you talk about in the book, where a very similar situation.
That's right. You know, Viktor Frankl, the main thing what he thought was that here I am in perhaps the worst situation any human being can be, but I have hope that someday I will be in a phenomenally better situation. And one thing that I've seen consistently amongst people who have really transformed is the tremendous stress and suffering they saw at they experienced at one point in their life. Mm-hmm. It was there from the depth of that stress and suffering they really transformed. So Chris, we do have a structured approach. Sometimes I call it transformation through disruption. You can see this event or this experience as that way. The downside of remaining stuck in negativity is it'll predispose you to chronic medical conditions. It'll predispose you to heart attack and stroke, perhaps even cancer. It'll predispose you to memory loss and lots of other negative outcomes. You cannot empower others to do that to you.
Thanks so much for that call, Chris. And actually, Michael in La Crosse has a question related to something you just said. So let's go there. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question specifically talking about the association with heart disease being the number one killer and stress. I wanted to see if there's any specific research or recommendations that we can talk to our family members or patients. I'm actually a physician assistant who works in cardiac surgery, and I wanted to know what can we do to better educate our patients to decrease the amount of stress in their lives.
That's a great question, Michael, and so nice to hear from a health professional who wants to share that kind of information. Dr. Sood, what would you say?
Yeah, thank you, Michael. So there is a conclusive relationship between stress and heart disease, both high blood pressure, angina, heart attack, and stroke, and even increased risk of sudden cardiac death, and overall all-cause mortality, all-cause death. The mechanisms are many, stress leading to increased adrenaline release with resultant elevation in blood pressure, more inflammation, changes in heart rate variability, and a lot of other different mechanisms that produce that link. What you can do about it is what really my focus is, and there's a lot you can do about. And one is, first of all, understanding how you get stressed. We have a two-step approach. One is to know your brain, how my brain operates and how it engages with the present moment, which produces stress. I believe everybody on our planet should know that basic understanding. Just as when you play piano, you ought to know a little bit about keyboard, I think we all need to understand how our brain operates, particularly the two modes. But the second and exciting part is engaging the brain in such a way that it produces more nourishing and nurturing thoughts and behaviors rather than stress-producing thoughts. We have six core skills that we share. The first one is gratitude, being grateful for little and larger things in life. Second is compassion, being compassionate to yourself and people around you. Acceptance, which is pragmatic acceptance, flowing with life, creatively working with what is. Focusing on meaning in life, which is the fourth skill, who am I and why am I in this world, and finally, forgiveness. All of these independently have been associated with multiple medical benefits, including benefits for cardiovascular disease. And the sixth component is learning to focus on what we want to focus on, being intentional about our focus. We have tested this combined approach in almost a dozen clinical trials and found them to be beneficial. A few participants have self-reported that they dropped their antihypertensive or their blood pressure came down quite a bit or they lost substantial weight without even trying. We have not done a formal study for high blood pressure or heart disease outcomes, but I have a very good belief that it will be impacted. Actually, in one study which we used with meditation, we tracked people's blood pressure, and it was the effect was equal to taking one antihypertensive.
Wow. Well, thank you for that call, Michael. And Dr. Sood, you kind of answered a question that I wanted to pose to you, which is, you know, how did the Mayo Clinic, which has so many interests and so many areas of expertise, how did the Mayo Clinic decide to prioritize something like the Guide to Stress-Free Living? Because this is actually coming out of a program, a workshop type format that you lead. And so how did the Mayo Clinic decide to put resources towards this kind of program?
Oh, sure. Mayo Clinic is focused not just on cure or palliation, but also on healing. And we see that patients who come here with chronic pain, with diagnosis of cancer, with inflammatory conditions, heart disease, and their caregivers experience tremendous amount of stress. And asking them to just take a deep breath or just find somebody to help them teach meditate or yoga just doesn't cut it. What we decided was to go and take a deeper look at why we get stressed from a real neurological perspective and evolutionary biology perspective and try to find out what makes us stressed and then develop programs to handle it in a more positive, productive way. Then we subjected those protocols that we developed to several clinical trials. We have now taught over 40,000 patients in this program, and every year we reach about 10 to 15,000 people. We reached a point, and we offered it to our staff. This is now broadly offered to our department chairs and leaders, and this is going to be part of the curriculum of all the Mayo Medical students. We reached a point where we said, you know, we are ready to share it with the world because we have seen benefits. I have literally thousands of emails from people who have been deeply and positively touched by this program. You can look at our website. I have a personal website too where I have shared some of the testimonials. And so we felt very compelled that we need to share it with the broader community.
Why don't you go ahead and give those websites so people can access them?
Well, it's my name, amitsood.com. That is one website where I share some of the programs, and there's a daily quote, and there's a whole theme, and there are excerpts of the book along with testimonials, research, and all of that.
And that's
the main website.
I wanted to spell it out for people, amitsood.com.
That's correct.
Great. And, you know, Dr. Sood, your book is very hopeful and very positive, and I think that's one of the reasons is it's really a joy to read. And one of the messages, I think, that gives it that positive and hopeful tone is that it's never too late to retrain our brains. And talking about that, you know, physiological basis, in what ways can we really retrain the brain?
You know, the structure of your brain tomorrow depends on the quality of your thoughts today. Your brain is like a river. It constantly rewires. So the way you engage your brain, and this is phenomenal. This is a gift to us to adapt around all the challenges that we face and the tremendous changes happening in the world. So when you engage, the intentionally engage and strengthen the right areas of the brain, they become more connected, they become stronger, they become the dominating force. It's almost like carving a new highway in your brain. Mm-hmm. So you have a choice. If you start intentionally thinking gratitude before you get out of bed in the morning, that's how you will become. And then over a period of months, you will start craving it. You will almost become addicted to gratitude, which I think is a good addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, we get people addicted to compassion and to pragmatic acceptance. We lower the threshold so people can easily access forgiveness, which is a big deal. A lot of times I see patients with severe illness. They're not bothered about their illness as much as they're bothered about the fact that they have not forgiven their aunt. They don't want to close their life before going through that. So the whole idea about this is becoming intentional, recognizing we have finite time on this planet. we have a choice. We truly have a choice which areas of the brain to engage. And what we have offered through this book and our programs is a structured approach, a compassionate structured approach, which is real world, which is pragmatic, which won't take, I promise you, it won't take even more than 5 minutes of your time during the day. It'll actually end up saving you a lot of time and doesn't take any extra energy.
I really liked in the book that you said, you know, starting the day with gratitude before you even get out of bed is such a good way to frame everything that happens after it. And you said, you know, if you find yourself in the bathroom brushing your teeth and you haven't done your gratitude, get yourself back to bed, do it, and start over. And you feel that strongly about how positive a difference that can make.
Absolutely. My mornings are different. So every day when I wake up, my first thought usually is I think about my wife. She may be sleeping by my side, but I send silent gratitude to her. And you can imagine that the energy with which I will connect with her 10 minutes later, when I meet her, if I'm already grateful to her, my energy will be much more positive. My whole morning goes slightly different and in a much more positive way when I practice this exercise. So that is why I have it, that take a post-it note, write the word gratitude on it, and stick it to your bathroom mirror. If you forget and you see that note, go back to bed and start over.
Well, and you talk about sending that same kind of gratitude to, say, the drivers of the cars around you when you're stuck in traffic, and they're not going to know it, but it really impacts how you feel about the experience of being stuck in traffic surrounded by these cars.
Yeah, I must confess, one of the most painful time of the day I've experienced is getting stuck. You know, when you're on traffic light, you just missed it, and now it's going to be red for next 3 minutes while you're late for a meeting. So I didn't know how to really engage in a positive way at that time. Then I had become used to this gratitude exercise. I said, well, let me think about all my high school teachers I'm grateful to. Well, let me think about my neighbors who have been kind to me. And suddenly that time has transformed into a very positive, joyous moment. So that is what I suggest to people, that when you are waiting at the traffic light, think about people you're grateful for.
We're talking with Dr. Amit Sood. He's the author of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. And we would be happy to have you join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones and Donna in Hartford. Hi, Donna.
Yes, good morning, Judith and Dr. Sood. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I find myself very much in the same sort of situation as your very first caller, different circumstances, but the stress is totally ongoing. I am a full-time caregiver, full-time caregiver for my aging mother, who is wonderful from the shoulders up, but everything from the shoulders down is very slow and immobile and very difficult for her. And I've been at this for a long, long time. Also took care of my dad for 10 years through Alzheimer's. And I have a sister who lives with us now most of the time, who has suffered from clinical chronic depression for basically her entire life, and puts forth an exorbitant amount of negativity and mental abuse almost on a daily basis to those of us who have to live around her. And she is my only teammate. There are other extenuating circumstances. It's nice to get help in the home, but they're always limited as to what they can do, and the funds are limited as to how much one can pay to have people at $25 an hour in your home for an entire day. Mm-hmm. We don't have that kind of funds. So outside of putting my mother into a nursing home, we take care of her at home, and I may say we're damn good at it. But on the other hand, this exorbitant amount of stress that I have been living under for my entire life with this individual who is on medication but does not go and get help for herself, and as we know in this country, it's very difficult to get mental health help if the individual doesn't seek it out for themselves.
Right.
And so we sit in this chronic cesspool of stress every single day. And I am working with some professionals right now to try to get the ball rolling, But as far as combining what you have to say, Dr. Sood, from your research, as opposed to, or maybe not as opposed to, but in conjunction with what the mental health world is saying, and then we can go one step further and talk about prayer, which I have an active prayer life, but believe me, I wake up in the morning not very grateful. I wake up in the morning with heat and prickling in my ears and numbness running down my arms from, anxiety, and I take a lot of supplements every single day to try to keep myself just balanced so I can get through every day. It sounds like your book is something I need. Whether or not I have time to actually read it is something else. And I think what the first woman was saying and what I'm crying out for, too, is maybe something that will never come, and that is a white knight to just take this all away, because we just don't know how much we can possibly handle without, as you pointed out, our health completely just going down and developing some sort of chronic health condition.
Sure. Thanks so much for that call, Donna. And Dr. Sood, certainly Donna is dealing with a whole lot. And your book does not minimize the tremendous stress and external factors that can weigh on people, like in Donna's case. What kind of help and hope can you offer to Donna?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your call, Donna. The book came from our experience with patients who are dealing with precisely the kind of stress that you described, Donna. Let me share with you briefly a story. This is a 43-year-old I saw, three children. She had a large brain tumor, and she was just given 6 months. And what she told me was, if you were to meet me 3 or 4 months ago, and she could barely walk, she was brought in wheelchair. So she said, if you met me 3 months ago, I would have been very upset because my kids used to whine while I would drive them, and I was so busy, I had no time, I felt underappreciated, and all that. But now I want those kids' whinings. I want to be a normal mom. I want to be a busy mom, but I can't do it. I've lost all my ordinary life, and I really crave for it. So sometimes we have to play the hand we have. I saw a patient recently who came and said, "Doctor, I am the only one suffering. Everybody else in the lobby seems okay." But if every patient is thinking that way, so there's a lot of stress and suffering, and I see a lot of it, more than my heart can contain, and very similar stories. Examples are different. I have a few suggestions. I'm happy to sit with you and talk heart to heart, but one suggestion that I offered to a patient of mine, this is several years ago, which really worked for her, was aligned with prayer that you're mentioning, and what I suggested to her was to see the Christ in her mother and serve her every day. And so that's what she would read. She would pray, she would read the scriptures, and she would say, for the next 4 hours, I'm going to serve the Christ in my mother, and then I would get, then she would get depleted. She would replete herself, and you get physically depleted, but you get more emotionally and spiritually depleted. And then she would replete herself and do that. And I saw her 6 months later, and she was really able to practice it well. See this as not a chore, but a privilege. The more you see this as a chore or putting you down, taking you away from meaning, I believe the magic is in finding meaning in what is the obstruction to prayer. This is what your prayer is. There is a beautiful story of Brother Lawrence, how he could find in everyday chores he could find his prayer and was able to engage. It's a very short, beautiful book, Practicing the Principles of. If you put Brother Lawrence, you'll find that story. So sprinkle some of the principles we have discussed so far in your life. Our brain, what research shows is every 1.5 to 2 hours, our brain needs a little bit of rest. If we don't do that, we'll get fatigued. So sprinkle gratitude or compassion or forgiveness or meaning, particularly gratitude or compassion, every 1.5 to 2 hours. Nature walk, appreciating something with the curiosity of a three-year-old, all of these engage you. When you meet your mother every day in the morning, meet her as if you haven't met her for a month. Try to see the novelty in her. And then recognize you are finite, you are limited, I am limited, we are all limited. You can only do your part. And I fully agree with prayer. Actually, I was thinking about writing a blog this morning that as a person with scientific background who needs evidence, I've I've not resisted, but I have struggled how exactly to what exactly to practice, but I really cannot do anything for that 43-year-old patient I talked about, or all the many patients I see who are going through suffering. All I can do is pray. That is the least I can do, and I think there is some power in it.
Thanks so much for that call, Donna, and I really do hope that you can take the time to read this book or other books that might help you reframe what your reality is. And Dr. Sood, that's a big part of it, is that you talk in the book about how large parts of our reality are just beyond our control to change.
That is right. You and I didn't pick our parents. We didn't pick the country of our birth. I didn't pick the 46 chromosomes that make me. I didn't pick my children or even my wife. You know, love happens. I didn't pick my children's health. I can't even assure that the next bowl of Caesar salad I'm going to eat doesn't have E. coli, mm-hmm. right? And so there's a lot that is not in my control. I can either fight it or I can accept it. Acceptance doesn't mean dispassion. I'm not going to engage. Acceptance means I'm going to creatively work with what is. I will make the most of my life wherever I'm thrown. So in Minnesota, I sometimes believe if I'm thrown in a ditch, it is because I'm being saved from a tornado. Hmm. And I sort of keep that belief and try to find positive in adversity as best as I can.
We are visiting with Dr. Amit Sood. He's professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic's College of Medicine and chair of the Mind-Body Medicine Initiative at the Mayo Clinic. His research interests include stress management, resilience training, meditation, smoking cessation, and cancer symptom control. And he is the author of the book, The Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. And we'd be happy to have you join us by phone at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe you're struggling with a particular stressor and you'd like Dr. Sood to help you reframe it, or maybe you have found some techniques of your own and you'd like to share those. We'd love to have you join us. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Dr. Amit Sood, who is the author of The Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. And Dr. Sood, we touched on the idea of stress as a threat, as one of the primary things that our brain is trained and designed to respond to. But there's also pleasure and novelty, and it's not as clear on the surface how the brain's wiring for pleasure and novelty could be related to stress, but it is. What's that connection?
Sure. There's something our three-year-old does to me that really lights me up every day. When I go home at the end of the workday, the best part of my day is when I meet our three-year-old, and she does two things. One is she finds me interesting every day. She finds me novel every day. And the second thing is she doesn't try to improve me. Mm. So that is novelty. Novelty is having the curiosity of a three-year-old. When you find everything around you magical and interesting, you don't wait for the perfect rainbow to enjoy. You enjoy the ordinary cloud that is floating in the sky, because that is magical. So novelty is what we pay attention to. If you were sitting with your partner, Judith, and your high school buddy shows up, who will be more interesting for the next 5 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be your high school buddy, right? though you love your partner, but your high school buddy is more interesting because high school buddy is more novel. So the idea of novelty is to connect with our loved ones by assuming that they are novel and engaging. So the more I focus on novelty, the less stressed I am, because I'm externalizing, I'm not in my default mode. The problem is we're married to the same person. When you've been married 20 years, partners become borderline boring. That's the reality, right? And so we start losing novelty. And one of the saddest expression I've heard was from a patient who came and said to me, you know, I divorced the wife I loved. This is a gentleman who came for supplements and herbal consult, and we quickly realized that, you know, he was in love with this woman, but being married for 20 years, he stopped appreciating the beauty that she brought to his life. And little things, little cracks became bigger. And then now 2 years later, he's recognizing that. So that is novelty. The second is pleasure. We also seek pleasure, absolutely. And the problem with pleasure, though, is that we adapt very quickly. When you reach the goalpost moves forward. This is called hedonic adaptation. So what pleases me yesterday stops pleasing me today. So there's no end to it. And that is why we focus on novelty more than pleasure. The interesting part is the more novelty you find, the happier you become.
And going back to the novelty, you talked about if you walked out of your house and saw a baby elephant dancing in your cul-de-sac, that's obviously novel and you get pleasure because it's something new and exciting that you don't see every day. It sounds like what you're saying, Dr. Sood, is that we need to try to see the baby dancing elephant in everything around us.
That is exactly right. You got it right. So so we wouldn't have, you know, the world will not put its energy in putting baby elephants in our cul-de-sac or on our walkway. But we have to find that joy in the Pomeranian that is running in our backyard. And the apple that is in the grocery store and the fact that, you know, there's sun rising in the east every day and it's beautiful and gorgeous. So when you change your threshold to little things making you happy and you sprinkle that multiple times during the day, you start living in a different world. It's almost like I believe that when you pay non-judgmental attention to the world around you and savor it, that gives you a preview of heaven.
Mm. And I think Bill in Sun Prairie would agree with you, Dr. Sood. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I want to comment on this entire process from a historical standpoint. I really applaud the doctors confirming a lot scientifically and rationally with studies and so forth a lot of these principles. But I also want to add that they're as old as the Buddha. This goes back 2,500 years, and many of the insights the Buddha had on the mind and thinking and living, not only in terms of these ideas of compassion, but also of wisdom and how to reframe your brain and rewire. All that is that old. And in recent history, it's come up in cognitive behavior therapy and other ways in pop psychology. But there's such a rich treasure in historical thought that I just wanted to emphasize. And a great many of much of it has to do with philosophy, to not only you know, look at things differently, but to understand the ethical basis of it. That's what my comment is.
And I think Dr. Sood would wholeheartedly agree. Is that correct, Dr. Sood?
Yes. Thank you, Bill. I totally agree with you. In the book, I have mentioned we actually I follow the honeybee model. I started with no preconceived notions, and I said, what makes sense? So I read scientific literature, I read philosophy, I read a lot of psychology literature, and I read works of multiple spiritual luminaries, spent almost a year thinking, and obviously met thousands and thousands of patients and started applying ideas on my own life. I actually researched what skills engage the right part of the brain. And I did a PubMed search on that, and the whole program came out of that. What is beautiful is that people of different faith, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and others, they've independently come and said, oh, this completely resonates with what I believe in. And to me, that is very positive, because these are the principles, the five core principles: gratitude, compassion, acceptance, meaning, and forgiveness. They unite us. They don't create any silos. And we have to be united if we have to move forward.
Thanks so much for that call, Bill. And Dr. Sood, we've talked a lot about gratitude, but it really feels like gratitude is kind of that first step that allows you to cultivate the other core principles. I can imagine people listening saying, oh, you know, it's going to feel so forced or so faked if I lay in bed and think, oh, I'm so grateful for my slippers that I'm about to put on because they're warm and they'll keep me from slipping on the floor. But it's okay if it doesn't feel completely natural at the start, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think, tell you of one study where they had people we have in our forehead, we have frown muscles. That when we frown or get unhappy, those muscles activate. So researchers, some people who had wrinkles, those frown muscles were paralyzed with Botox. And actually, people became happier just because they couldn't frown.
Wow.
And even their brain networking, the way their brain was engaged, the lower limbic brain became less active. So there is a brain-face feedback. When you're happy, your face looks happy. When your brain is happy, your face looks happy. But when your face is happy, your brain also becomes happier.
Hmm.
So let's, I think if you allow me, Judith, we can
sure.
do a two-minute gratitude meditation together if you are at some place safe.
Absolutely.
Will that be okay?
Mm-hmm.
So let's sit with eyes closed, and I'll just share with you how I try to wake up every morning. So imagine you're waking up this morning and you become aware of yourself and the world around you.
Okay.
Now think about the first person in your life you want to be grateful for, and bring that person's face in front of your eyes.
All right.
And then send your silent gratitude to that person.
Done.
Second person.
Okay.
And go back to the first memory of this person, the first time you saw this person.
Hmm. Okay.
And then send your silent gratitude.
All right.
Think about someone who has passed away, who you loved.
Okay.
Give that person a virtual hug.
Okay.
And then send your silent gratitude.
Okay.
Go back in time and look at yourself when you were 8-year-old.
Hmm. Okay.
And then send silent gratitude to your 8-year-old self.
Done.
And then you can open your eyes.
All right.
So that is a mini version of what we do. It took about a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So our gratitude is not about slippers or things or nature. It's really about people.
Mm-hmm.
People in our life, because we live and breathe our life in the context of family and relationships.
Right. That's very true. And as you said, I think, you've never had a patient who has a framed copy of their IRA statement up on the wall in their hospital room. It's pictures of family and it's pictures of the people that matter to them, that they're living for, really.
Absolutely. I think the three most important parts of our life is our relationships, and relationships. We don't feast enough on quality time. We focus so much on goods and goodies, but that we do it at the cost of good time, having a good time. So I think when I see people in my practice, the biggest struggle they have is with relationship. And there are two relationships, relationship with others, but most importantly, relationship with yourself.
Mm. And that I really liked that you had me, or had all of us who are listening, go back and send gratitude to our 8-year-old self.
Yes, we did a little study, actually. We had about 50 people who had trained with us. We asked them to look at their 8-year-old self and tell something that they would learn. And it was all about self-acceptance.
Mm.
We find we are so hard on ourselves. We are a generation of givers. Everybody I meet, every single person is obsessed with giving out their energy. Our callers, I think Chris was saying the same thing.
Yes.
So was Donna. They really love to give their physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual energy, but we are not good at receiving.
And
the
idea
is to
receive. Yeah, not just from others, but from ourselves as well.
Exactly. And when you accept yourself, when you're grateful for yourself, when you're compassionate towards yourself, and when you forgive yourself, then you've begun to receive. Now, when you receive, you're stronger, kinder, and happier, and then you can give more.
And we are coming up on a look at the news, but let's take a call from Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi. This is a wonderful show. I wonder if the doctor would comment a little bit about the kind of heart attack that I had, which is due entirely to stress, and that is Taco Subo. I had that attack in April of 2012. Despite all of my checkups and everything have been just fine, and they did not find a blockage. And when they looked at my enzymes, they realized what had happened. And when they looked at my history, they realized what had happened. And, you know, that's when your stress level is, there's no hills and valleys. So you're just up stressed all the time, and your adrenaline and your cortisol levels stay up, and they stun your heart. And they didn't take it seriously, you know, because there wasn't a lot of it attributed to that for many years until they had the earthquake and the nuclear accident in Tokyo in Japan, and they had sort of a captive study right there. All these people were having Takotsubo because it can also be attributed to a trauma, which, of course, would be stressful. But for me, it was, you know, I'd been holding up the department that I was in at our university for years, and later on, after all was said and done, by a year later of my, you know, having to restructure my life from go, go, go to, okay, maybe I better let that go and staying calm, I realized how arrogant it was of me to think I should or could hold up my world like Atlas holding up the world. It almost killed me. So it's very hard to make yourself go the other way and think in terms of, is this good for me? Is it good for my spirit? And by the way, 80 to 90% of the victims are women, because we process stress differently. Men know where to draw the line. So at any rate, I'm sure the doctor can comment more, but I think it's important that we do address that in terms of stress.
And thank you so much for that call, Anita. Dr. Sood, we only have about 30 seconds left before we're going to the news, but I'm guessing that you're not surprised that there's that kind of correlation between, like, high cortisol levels and a heart attack.
Yeah, you said many things right, Anita, about the disease. I'm very familiar with Takotsubo condition, cardiomyopathy. I've seen several patients help them. It is related to excessive stress, toxic level of adrenaline.
And actually, Dr. Sood, we are going to go to a news break, but we will be back right after that. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. When we talk about ideas like acceptance or compassion, maybe forgiveness, we often think of giving them to others. But what about treating ourselves with the same kindness and attention? Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Amit Sood is a professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and chair of the Mind-Body Medicine Initiative at Mayo Clinic. His research interests include stress management, resilience training, meditation, smoking cessation, and cancer symptom control. And he's the author of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. He joins us today from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Sood, thank you again for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, Judith. May I complete thoughts for Anita?
Yes, or? Please do. So just to refresh people's memory, Anita was talking about having had very high levels of continual stress and it resulting in a heart attack.
Yeah. So, Anita, this event has, and this can have, you can have recurrence of this event if you do not control your stress very well. It shows that your system is sensitive. You can either take that as a negative or you can take that as an opportunity that this is telling you that, look, Anita, you have to really grow emotionally and spiritually. You have to ask questions like, what went right within what went wrong? Will it matter 5 years from now? Anything that won't matter 5 years from now, don't let it matter to you today. People who are upset are actually saying, help me. An expression other than love is a call for help. Forgive yourself, accept yourself. You're trying to be perfectionist. And as Judith was mentioning, we are very hard on ourselves. Judge yourself by your intention. Look at yourself with the eyes of somebody who completely trusts your intention. You are who your pet thinks you are. So your self-acceptance won't create apathy. And sprinkle these thoughts multiple times during the day.
And
so that your brain is not depleted and you're able to remain energized.
And you were talking earlier, Dr. Sood, about, you know, people having people do the exercise of going back and telling their younger selves something. And I really think that the item that you just mentioned is so key, that, you know, will this matter 5 years from now? I certainly remember being a much younger person and being completely overwhelmed by stresses of trying to support myself and getting through school and you know, having a job that pays and finding relationships that were satisfying. satisfying and healthy. And everything seemed like the biggest issue I would ever deal with. And if I could go back and tell that younger Judith, you know what, you're going to get through, you're going to be stronger, and this is just one short period of a much longer happy life, you know, I think that would make all the difference in the world. And if we can do that for ourselves now, maybe more in middle age, you know, pretending that we're the 80-year-old person coming back and telling us, it's kind of the same principle.
Absolutely. I really encourage you, all of you, to write, you know, at 11:30, what bothered you in 2008 that continues to bother you today? And I promise your list is likely to be just a few things, but I'm sure many things bothered you. So I have a promise to myself. Anytime I face an adversity, I ask myself, will I bother about it in 2018? And if the answer is no, I just learn from it the best I can, engage, and let it go. Because I know my brain is a premium real estate. I've got finite thoughts to think. When I'm thinking bad, I just wrote this yesterday, when I'm thinking bad about somebody who is bad, during that time, I'm not thinking good about somebody who is good.
Very interesting.
So you have a choice, right? So I can think bad about somebody who's bad, or I can think good about somebody who's good.
And we can also think badly about something about ourselves, or we can celebrate something good about ourselves.
Absolutely. We judge yourself by your intentions, not the outcome of your actions. If your intentions are bad, then you have to do something about it. But if your intentions are good, do not be hard on yourself. We are too hard on ourselves.
And I want to share a couple things on Facebook, and then we'll get back to the phones because we have several people who want to join in. But we have two very different comments on Facebook. One is from John, and he says, today we can be grateful for being warm if we are warm. And it's quite chilly in Wisconsin. I'm guessing in Rochester, Minnesota, you're in a deep freeze as well.
Absolutely. But we, you know, I look at snow, and certainly I don't like the snow on the road when it is slippery. But I often tell our kids, this is what we're going to drink in the summer. Mm. So
I think it's beautiful if you can look at snow that way, especially on a sunny day where it's magical, really. But the other comment is from Mary on Facebook, and she says, what about the story of Pollyanna playing the quote unquote glad game every day is the same thing? And so I think she's saying, you know, being positive all the time just isn't natural and isn't the way to go.
Actually, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I actually don't believe in positive thinking. I don't believe in negative thinking either. So because when you think positive, you're pulled towards negative. When you're thinking negative, you're pulled towards positive. I believe in principles-based thinking. What is true and honest? And having a wide, broad perspective, the idea is not to be Pollyanna. The idea is to recognize that there are enough blessings going around that I can be content in this moment. That I'm still there is still a lot that is right in my life. Ask yourself: is the cumulative amount of stuff in your life is it more positive or more negative? When you're flying, for example, do you carry all the load on your head or do you check it in? I'm sure you check it in, but our mind carries all of our life's load in our head all the time. We don't need to do that. We need to cross the street. We need caution, but not fear. And that is what this is about. The Pollyanna is just not what this is. This is not even positive thinking. This is principles-based thinking. This is focusing on truth.
And I think it's also choosing what you're going to focus on.
Exactly. That is such an important word, intentional. We want to be intentional about how we think, what we think, what we focus on. Action and speech automatically follows. We don't exercise that choice of intentionality because our brain remains in the default mode. Most of my patients tell me 2/3 to 80% of the time. This is nobody's fault. Brain is trying to do what it is designed to do. I promise you, it will keep you in your default mode for 80% of your time, barely aware of what's happening around you. But if you take charge and do simple things to reframe, engage, be more intentional and focused, your brain starts rewiring. And once you have traveled in business class, you don't want to then go back to economy. Once you have, you know, I travel economy, though. But once you have engaged the right part of the brain and find joy in the little things, which you did at some point in your life when you were 3-year-old perhaps, you would not want to live any other way.
And let's go to Susan in Eau Claire. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. This is a wonderful program, and I'm very interested in the creative parts of our brain and our beings, whether it's gardening or winemaking or embroidery. I think it helps ground us, and I think one problem with it can be that sometimes we let others judge our creativity skills on whether they think they're good or not. And so I would like to encourage people not to let that happen, and I'd love to have some comments by Dr. Sood on how creativity can keep us grounded and improve our lives.
Great. Thanks for that call, Susan. Dr. Sood?
Yes, creativity is intentionality. When you're being creative, you're intentional, you're on top of your game, you are in a state of flow. And when you're being creative, at that very moment, you can't be catastrophizing at the same time. So creativity pulls you out of your default mode of stewing on stuff, of mind wandering. So I love creativity. The more we can sprinkle creativity, we need creativity as a nation. But creativity is not about achieving the perfect snowman, of having the best snowman in your cul-de-sac. Creativity is about the process of creating snowman, about the giggles and laughs you have, about the slip-ups you have, about the nth time that the head is not round enough. That is what is creativity about. It's the process that you enjoy, and it is the experience of creating and knowing that it is going to melt, but creating it anyways.
Well, and maybe that dancing baby elephant in your cul-de-sac is going to knock it over anyway.
Right, or the giraffe.
You're right. Well, thanks for that call, Susan. Let's go next to Deborah in Madison. Hi, Deborah.
Yes. I had, first of all, I also am so grateful for this show. I'm taking notes like crazy, and this is so pertinent to my own chronic anxiety, which I really didn't understand was what I was dealing with until a few years ago. And I'm a 56-year-old woman. So my primary question is about relationships, and I can see this condition kind of running through a certain part of my family, back to my dad and back to his mom, and I have a 22-year-old son who I've been trying to share as I'm learning about my own condition and my own brain, how it works. I've been trying to share that information with my son, and we have a good communication about that. And so I guess my question is, please speak to the passing on of this condition through genetics, through bloodlines, and also a little bit about damage control. Family relationships are very difficult.
Right.
With my father, he hasn't had access to the same medical knowledge that I have. Brain research just has been, you know, flooding with progress in the last 10 years. And so I have empathy for my father, but also it's so very difficult to deal with him.
Sure. And let's give Dr. Sood a chance to comment. So anxiety disorders and their relation to stress, is there a direct relationship, Dr. Sood?
Yes. Stress is often associated with something external or internal. Anxiety sometimes can be free-floating. You may feel anxious but do not have the reason. And there are medications and other approaches. Part of it is genetic. Half your happiness is genetic, about 40%, and the rest is related to what you do to yourself and your circumstances. So clearly there is a predisposition, but there is a lot in your control. One of the most important things is to recognize is that don't hurt yourself by self-blame if you feel anxious. I see this a lot. People who have chronic pain, they don't feel validated, and that just doubles and triples their pain. So validate yourself. Recognize, yes, I have anxiety. This is who I am. I am sensitive, but I'm going to work with it. And then I'll engage with gratitude, compassion, self-acceptance, meaning, and forgiveness, which will help my anxiety. It can go to your children through genetic or behavioral aspects. One of the key things to recognize is in your own situation and to help your children particularly is to remind them how good they are. I just wrote this email to my group of students here, and I'll read it, a few sections of it. One is, so the email was, "Dear friends, some of us know it, many don't. Some of us knew it but have forgotten. Some will remember in this life. Many will take their last breath without realizing this one simple truth. We are all hungry for love. You, me, they, all of us. You can improve your every living moment by remembering this simple fact. And how do you give love? You give love when you are grateful for people and show it. When you're compassionate to others and yourself. When you accept them as they are with no desire to improve them." Well, one caveat is, if somebody asks you, "Am I good enough?" you say, "You're perfect as you are, but you can be better." So there's always room for improvement. When we miss on that acceptance, then we get anxious, then we get lonely, we get depressed, we get sad. What I ended up that email was that, may you live in a world that loves you, and may you love the world you live in. I think that love has many expressions: gratitude, compassion, acceptance, patience, your undivided attention, all of those. The more you give that to yourself and others around you, the happier you will be. One final point is, when you receive that kind of love, your brain's happy area gets activated, but your brain's happy area also gets activated when you give that kind of love.
That's wonderful to share. And Dr. Sue, there's so much in the book that we haven't covered yet, but there's something that I want to make sure we get to, and that's that you talk about how important a tribe is to our health and happiness. What do you mean by a tribe?
Well, let me ask you, Judith. Say you win, I hope this happens to you, say you win $50 million in Powerball. How many people you will call, you know, will be really happy for you but not want a dime? I hope there are a few people like that.
When I read the book and came to that, I actually could think of several people that I was quite confident would just be overjoyed for me with no expectations for themselves.
That is your tribe. And they may be not in physical proximity to you, but people who want your good and have no selfish intention and have roughly similar moral values, these are the people in your tribe. Nurture that tribe. Have at least a few people if you can, and have them as part of your tribe. So that is the core tribe we need to build as we grow, because this tribe supports you, nurtures you. It is your shock absorber. This is the tribe that you get back to when you're facing adversity or joy. You know, it is more difficult to share joy than it is to share sorrow. There was a study, "Will you be there for me when things go right?" How many people can you share with when you really have something positive happening in your life?
Wow, so that's interesting.
So you seed that tribe by becoming a person like that for others, by bringing your kindness world over. The single most important trait that we appreciate in our partner is kindness. So being kind to yourself and kind to others, that is how you seed your tribe. You feed your tribe by shared meaning, by laughter, by listening a lot, by speaking kind words. And then you weed your tribe. You're very careful with arguments. You're very careful with saying no. You're careful with critique. You're careful with anger. So that's how you seed, feed, and weed your tribe. And we have a whole section actually on tribe, which is extremely important, where we bring all the skills together.
And you talk about, you know, that inner circle of people that you can trust and feel safe with, and that will share your joy, not just your sorrow. But you also talk about rings of the tribe that go further out, and that furthest out ring of the tribe can be as broad as we want it to be, even encompassing the whole world and all the people in the world. But I wonder, is there a risk of being overwhelmed by the suffering that is out there as well when you feel that connected to that many people?
There is definitely a risk. So you have to increase your diameter of existence, your psychological existence, to the point where you feel capable. So if you can only think about your family and your neighborhood, that's just fine. But as you grow, because true compassion, there's a difference between compassion and empathy. Empathy is when I try to feel your feeling. Compassion is when I truly do something to improve it, and that something could be just a prayer. So my personal meditation every day is I think about every day 350,000 babies are born on this planet, and I think about the suffering many of them will go through right after birth, and what I dedicate my meditation and prayer is to the well-being of those babies. You know, you don't have to imagine too much. Don't get too graphic. Don't be fearful that adversity will happen to you. But truly pray for the well-being. That will not increase your risk of having adverse symptoms from connecting with a larger world than you can handle.
And that's kind of similar to one of the core principles is acceptance. And you make a very clear point that being accepting of others does not mean taking abuse from them or being a doormat for them either.
Oh, absolutely. Acceptance is empowering. It means you stop fighting yourself. An example I give is if your doorbell rings and a little girl is selling Girl Scout cookies, and say you don't eat Girl Scout cookies, will you shove the door in her face or will you buy more than you should? So even though you may not eat those cookies, you still engage with life. Acceptance is creatively working with what is. It is being open to the possibilities. Acceptance is, there's an old saying, trust your God, but tie your camel. It is that combination where with this faith and fact. Acceptance doesn't mean you let go of facts. And it also doesn't mean you let go of faith. It is paradoxical. That is why it is not that easy. But one good thing is the path to acceptance is through gratitude. Mm-hmm. The more grateful you are, the easier it is for you to accept. And that is why we have these six core skills integrated with each other, because each one of them individually is vulnerable. This realization I had a few years ago, that if I just practice compassion, I'm vulnerable. If I practice gratitude, I'm vulnerable. Forgiveness doesn't even make sense if I'm not grateful and compassionate and accepting. But when you put these all together, it becomes like wonderful curry that can soup up, that can spice up any meal.
And so in just the minute or so we have left, to start the new year, what's the first step people can take if they want to try and reduce their stress through the kind of thinking and reshaping our brains that you've talked about?
I think recognizing that you have a choice. Do not let past dominate your present moment. Look forward, recognize that you truly have a choice, and I don't mean this in a metaphoric or an ethereal way. You truly have a choice which part of the brain you engage and empower. Do you want to engage, remain in the default mode, barely aware of the external world, focusing on neutral or negative thoughts and continuing with status quo? Or do you want to engage the focused mode, be intentionally present, become stronger, kinder, happier, and align your life so that you achieve your highest potential? We have one responsibility. Our responsibility is to collectively create a kinder and happier world for our planet's children. And that is what all my efforts are geared towards, and that is what I invite you to do too.
And you say that you want to change the mantra from survival of the fittest to survival of the kindest, and I think that you're getting us well on that way.
Thank you, and I'm so grateful to you, to all the listeners, and to Mayo Clinic for resonating with this, and we are so excited. This is wonderful time where we can share this broadly through book and through other programs and channels that we have begun to offer. A lot more is to come in the coming years.
And we did have a little follow-up on Facebook. Mary, who talked about the Pollyanna story, said, I really wasn't trying to be negative or positive. I like the GLAD game and think we are on the same wavelength. So that was a nice follow-up to get. Thank you, Mary. And Dr. Amitsud, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Judith. Take care.
You too. Dr. Amitsud is a professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and chair of the Mind-Body Medicine Initiative at Mayo Clinic. He's the author of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. And you can find out more about the book and about Dr. Amitsud's work at amitsud.com. That's AMITSOOD.com. www.totallytogether.com. Well, coming up tomorrow at 11, we'll talk with Stephanie O'Day. She's the author of Totally Together, Shortcuts to an Organized Life. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network.